morning.
Good morning, Sensei.
I see some new faces. Maybe you're not new. I've been away for a couple of weeks. So before I give my talk, I just want to mention a couple of things. The first one is Daisan, which if you're not familiar with what that is, it's an opportunity to meet with the teacher, whether me or if you're some other Zendo, there's usually some setup for that. And people go for a variety of reasons. Some people have carried for a long time the question of, who is it that I am? Other people sit at home and they don't know how to fit their practice in with family life. Some people are puzzled by, why do I even bother to do this? Some people have difficulty sitting, and they don't know how to deal with that. So there can be practical questions, there can be life questions, the spiritual nature. And so Daisan is just the opportunity to talk to somebody that's been around the block, so to speak. So if there's a lot of concepts, a lot of things that we talk about, and I don't like to assume that everybody is familiar with these. So I'm going to give a talk, and I'm going to mention things that some people may not be familiar with. The talk is basically about essential nature. And essential nature is sometimes called Buddha nature, our true self, and other words like that, that name who we are. But we have two faces, and it doesn't mean we're two-faced in the usual sense. So there's the face that we're all familiar with, and that's the face of the person that gets up every morning and goes to work. That's the face of the person who has children who they take care of and love. That's the face of somebody who's married and has a husband or a wife. That's the face of somebody who may be involved in a particular social movement, or the person who has a lot of wonderful friends and they enjoy a good laugh, and so on. All those different aspects of who we are in our daily life. So if I ask the question, who are you? That's the reference point that most people have. But Zen also doesn't dismiss that, the everyday self of who we are, but it points to a self that we're less familiar with. And that's the self, that's who we are, when all those labels of who we are drop away. One of the common koans that people hear all the time is, what is your face before your mother is born? So we immediately go to all the concepts, all the ideas that we have to respond to that. But that's the self, that's the person that has all these attributes, father, son, parent, athlete, all those attributes. That's the face we try to answer that question from. And there is no answer from that side. It's the other side, the other face, that's not defined by all those concepts. And we call, like I said, we call that essential nature, true nature, Dharma nature. I hope that helps when I go through this talk. And in this talk, I'm going to use several poems by Han Shan, who is a Chinese poet from around the late 8th and early 19th century. And back in those days, the good old days of Zen, there were many wandering monks in the mountains of China, and many of them lived in seclusion. And Han Shan was one of those. Actually, there were two, Han Shan and Shi Te, and they were sort of Dharma buddies, and the sort of crazy wisdom. And they lived and traveled around in the mountains. And I love a lot of the poems by Han Shan, so I'll be using three or four of those poems as part of my talk. But in case you're wondering where did they come from, that's where they come from Han Shan. And it's from a book, The Clouds Should Know Me By Now, and it's a book of Han Shan's poem. Now they're not typical poems. They're sort of narrative in a way, and also a poem in another way. And this is a poem by Han Shan which may give you a feeling for this wandering monk that he was. Clambering up the cold mountain path, the cold mountain trail goes on and on. The long gorge, choked with scree and boulders, the wide creek, the mist-blurred grass, the moss is slippery, though there's been no rain. The pine sings, but there is no wind. Who can leap the world's ties and sit with me among the white clouds? So that gives a feeling, at least on one level, that gives a feeling for where it was that these monks wandered. And Han Shan named himself Cold Mountain. So these poems that I'm talking about are called the Cold Mountain Poems. So again, Han Shan wrote, "Know that in a remote place, in a cloud-covered valley, there is still a sacred pine that passes through the chill of the ages. Times change, but the pine is always there. It passes through the chill of the ages." So you are that pine. I am that pine. No matter how much time passes, no matter how obscured by clouds each of us is, our true nature, our essential nature, remains. It is that sacred pine. And this essential nature, therefore, remains through conditions, through good health and bad, love and loss, fear and shame, anger, joy, and on, all those things that arise. But at the same time, this true nature is always there. It always remains. Now, another way to express this is using the question, when everything is emptied out, our identity, all the things we know, all the things we believe, what is it that cannot be emptied? What is it that cannot be emptied? Our essential nature is always present. It's never out of reach, whether we are aware of it or not. And we don't have to look somewhere else to discover this essential nature. It's always here right now. And the reason that we do zazen is to realize the truth of what I'm saying. And we sit, in order to discover this, we sit to empty our minds, to still our minds, to put aside all those things that we think we are. They're there, they exist. But when the mind is still, when we still our mind with zazen, a whole new part of us is revealed. And what's revealed is that the true nature, our essential nature, is that we are one with everything. But even one with everything has to be dropped, because if we say one with everything, we get pulled over to the other side, the side of concepts and ideas. Now, the realization or the discovery through experience of this true nature, this essential nature, is named enlightenment. This is the name that we give to the experience of realizing our other face. Clouds release the hillsides and wake the scenes of spring. Where is the plum tree that walks, that subtle scent? I grab my staff, intending to search secluded valleys, then find a single branch against my eastern wall. I grab my staff, intending to search secluded valleys, and then find a single branch against the eastern wall. So that's the pine again, right? We think that there's something to find, something to search for, something that's outside ourselves. But the pine is right here. He prepares to go on this search and discovers his true nature, the pine, which is the metaphor, right here, right there. So I think of my own spiritual history, the spiritual history that leads up to the discovery of Zen. And it's hard for me to really get in touch, as much as I've tried, to exactly what it was. But from a very early age, I was pulled by something. There was something that I was looking for that I felt that I was missing. And it was sort of a, for me, sort of a wild ride in this search. When I was about 9 or 10 years old, my grandmother used to take me to Madison Square Garden to hear Billy Graham, who is a very dramatic speaker. And so the only memory that I have of it, which is probably because I was most moved by it, is Billy Graham who's very charismatic, standing on the stage, and in one hand he has this really big Bible that's sort of flopping on each side of his hand. And I remember him, and I can't do the voice, but in his Billy Graham voice, holding the Bible up and saying, "The Bible says." And there was something about that. Yeah, the Bible says. And so I was attracted to that. And I'm only 10 years old, so I was limited in how deep I could go with that. And then as I grew up, I also grew up a Lutheran. And my family went to the Lutheran church every Sunday. But their attachment to the church, I think, was more just the protocol of a family growing up. Because religion was never talked about in our house. Never, not once that I can ever remember. Yet my father was the president of the church council. But there was a minister, Charles Martin Luther Obacare, who had been a football player, a fullback, I think, at Gettysburg College. And he was pretty young. He was probably in his 30s. So all of us kids in particular were, wow, this guy's our minister. And he would stand up there, and he was a real sort of a fire and brimstone kind of guy. But again, that charisma attracted me. And I began to have thoughts that maybe someday I would be a minister. Then life took me to college in the early 70s. And of course, one of the ways that we thought in those days that was an entryway into spirituality was drugs, particularly LSD. And just a quick aside, I just read a book about Junpo Roshi, who was one of the biggest sellers of LSD back in those days. He made millions of dollars. He had this very elaborate system of selling LSD. And he's now a Roshi, just so you know. Some of these histories can be pretty sordid. So anyway, so there was the use of drugs, which I didn't get into that much. But there was also now this whole wealth of literature of all these teachers coming here. And I read this stuff voraciously. And there was a period of time where Ram Dass was my minister. You know, Ram Dass was now the new charismatic person. And myself and my friends who were on this path together, you know, we would talk about all this stuff that we read. We had no experience with it, but we talked about it a lot to the point where my friend Alan's wife would say, "Oh, not that Ram Dass crap again." So that went on like that. And then my first entryway into actually meditating and having an experience was, I think it was again at Madison Square Garden, when the Maharishi Yogi came to the United States and I learned transcendental meditation, which is meditation with a mantra that you repeat while you're sitting. So that was sort of my first taste. And I actually had some kind of experience, I don't remember it well anymore, that sort of moved me to keep going. But I still, even though I did that, I came across Zen and I took up Zen from afar. There was something about it that attracted me. The simplicity and the directness of it. And I think, too, the Japanese flavor of it. You know, there's Chinese Zen and there's a variety of Zens, Tibetan Zen. But there was something about the Japanese form of Zen that was, to me, attractive. And then my friend Dennis started sitting in New York with Eido Roshi. And he asked me to come one time. I think I might have told this story, maybe some of these stories before. So I went into New York with Dennis, and that was my first time sitting Zazen. Like all of us, when you start out with something like this, especially the Japanese form, it's very strict and very orderly, and it's a very tight shoe in one way. And so, you know, I was nervous, I was uncomfortable, and then in that particular lineage, everybody is expected to go to Daisan. And when they ring the bell, this is particularly true at retreats, when they ring the bell, everybody rushes to Daisan, almost literally pushing each other out of the way. Because the spirit of it, this is where you meet the heart of Zen, in Daisan. So I was much more timid. I didn't push anybody out of the way. I meekly got in line. And so eventually I got to see Eido Roshi, and he was a classic Japanese Roshi. You know, very fierce. He was Rinzai. You know, there's two forms of Zen. There's Soto, which is the gradual sort. It's, you know, it's not that boom, boom, boom. It's much more slow and gentle. And the other side is Rinzai, which is koans, 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 stick, sit up, right? That's the Rinzai side. Now, to some degree, I'm exaggerating, but not much. So I went in and I sat down with Edo Roshi. And I had all these ideas about what this is like, you know, who he was and all this stuff. So I went with all the stuff that I read. And he said something to me like, "Who are you?" And I was like, "Oh my God, let me out of here." So, of course, as a kid, my father used to always say to me, you know, the older you get, the dumber you get. So there was always this part of me that I carried, which was very insecure about being stupid, particularly stupid in front of somebody else. And so here I am, and I feel like really stupid because I have no idea what this question means. And so I didn't last long in there. I gave some feeble attempt to answer, and he just rang the bell, and that was it. But that was another phase of this search for something. There's got to be something out there that I can find. Something to fill this hole. But what I hadn't realized was that this essential nature, my true nature, is always here. I'm carrying it around, looking for it. And slowly, through actually practicing Zen with teachers that I was more comfortable with, I began to realize that there is nothing to get, that I have everything that I need, that I'm perfectly complete as I am. And it's not just me, it's all of us. We are perfectly complete as we are, but we don't know it. So I realized that I had to lift the curtain of ideas and concepts. And another way to say this is I had to empty myself of ideas and concepts and realize my true nature. And we'll talk often about emptiness and emptying ourselves. And if you've been here for a while, you've heard this probably ad nauseum at this point. So let me go back to Han Shan. After late spring rain, the falling petals swirl. Weightlessly, celestial scent covers my patched robe. A simple, vacant mind has no place to go. Resting on the peak, I watch the clouds return. This is the heart of what I'm saying. A simple, vacant mind, an empty mind, has no place to go. It's right here. There is no place to go. If your mind is vacant, which my mind was not for many, 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 many years, which is why I wandered around looking for something that was right under my nose. So I was thinking about this, you know, not being in touch when it's right under our nose. And I was thinking about, you know, the question that I asked earlier, who are you? And that we usually drift over to the side of all the labels, all the roles that we have. And I was wondering, you know, so why does this come about? And it occurred to me that this process starts from birth. As soon as we are born, as soon as we come into the world, we have a relationship. Right? And we have some sense of this relationship. Now that relationship, I'll use myself as an example, when I was in my mother's womb, that relationship was, there's just us, right? There was no separation of Carl and Mom. Right. But as soon as I'm born, a separation occurs, and there is my mother, and there is me. And then in order for me to function in the world, my parents start teaching me, this is food, food good, this bad. Or laugh, that's laugh, you're laughing, or you're crying. Or that's our dog. And then slowly as it evolves, then, you know, you learn to take the dog for a walk. And so we become all of these things that are natural part of human development, that are based in thoughts, concepts, and beliefs, right? And this is how we function in the everyday world. And that becomes the only way that we answer this question is who we are. We are all these experiences, all these ideas, all these beliefs, all the roles that we assume as we progress out of the womb. And that's the person that we know. But that's only half of who we are. So all these ideas, all these beliefs is what we talk about when we say we have to empty ourselves. It doesn't mean that that side of who we are is the enemy. It just means that that's one side. We know that side very well. And the parts we don't know, we go to see a therapist about. At least I. But the other side is the side that we don't know. And it's the empty side. The side without this particular kind of identity. So the practice of Zazen is to, in some ways, put aside, while we're sitting, this person that we know, this self. It's always there, just like true nature, it's always there. But our focus is now to learn about who we are when all those things are not present. And the process, the Zen process of doing this, leads to what we call awakening. We awaken to this other side. We experience this other side, which has been there all along. Now, this process is not easy. In order to realize, in order to experience the other side of ourselves, our true nature, we have to stick with it. Stick with it through thick and thin. And to do this, we must have confidence in ourselves. It's very easy to get discouraged. It's a bumpy road to discovering our true nature. So it's really important to have confidence. Right? Have confidence in ourselves and our ability, and have confidence in the truth that there is something behind the curtain. Now, I remember when I studied with my teacher, Roshi Kennedy, working with him, and this is when I got to the point of working with koans, really tried my confidence in myself. I can remember one time going to see him. This is when I was working with Mu, which is called an entry koan. It's the first koan that we studied. And the koan is, does a dog have Buddha nature? And again, that's like asking, what is your face before your mother is born? Does a dog have Buddha nature? You can't respond to that in the usual way. So one day, I was really excited to present my response, my answer. So I gave the answer, which I don't remember what it was anymore, but I do remember him looking at me with this quizzical look on his face and saying, "Carl, that's a good answer for the next koan." So, you have to have confidence to keep going. And, you know, me, who was raised, the older you get, the dumber you get, I'm in there, and that part of myself, on the other side of the fence, is my heart is pounding and I feel embarrassed like a fool. But for whatever reason, I had the confidence to keep going. Just one other thing that happened with Mu, I came in and gave a response to Mu. And again, and this is not condescending or mean-spirited, but Roshi has this expression that as soon as you see it, at least as soon as I saw it, I knew that, no, this is not it. He didn't have to say a word, really. All I had to do was see the expression. So in this particular case, he said, he was referring to the koan, and he sort of leans over like this, and then he sits back and he says, "Carl, it's a metaphor." So I know from the inside out about having confidence. And not letting the rug getting pulled out from under you, which is part of the process, don't let that discourage you. Just stay with it. Whether it's remembering to go back to 10 when you're breathing or whether you're doing the koan work, it doesn't matter. It's the same thing. You have to have that confidence to keep going. Now, one of the benefits of having a teacher is that he or she can support us through these difficult times. That's why that door is open, right? You can go in there and have somebody say, "It's okay, stick with it." Right? Trust yourself. And there's an old saying, I don't remember where this comes from, but knock down 7 times, get up 8. And that's the determination, the confidence in ourselves that we have to keep going. I usually give short talks. I'm sorry. I'm going to cut this short. Resting at my open window, I gaze out at the mountain. 1,000 peaks of blue and purple rise above the pines. Without a thought or care, white clouds come and go, so utterly accepting, so totally relaxed. So one last metaphor asked, if I was asked who I am at one particular point in my life, part of that face was that I was a sailor. I used to do a lot of sailing. And inevitably, if you sail, you encounter fog. So all the things that we usually orient ourselves, right, our everyday self, all the things that as a sailor you orient yourself, right, with buoys and land or your position by plotting, it's all gone, right? You're sailing in the fog. You can't see a damn thing. And so it requires from the sailor to have confidence in yourself. You do what you do, you know what to do, and you have confidence that when the fog lifts, you will be pretty close to where you're heading, not on the rocks. And so this is very similar, you know, this pulling up the shade that I talked about is like the fog lifting. You know, we spend most of our lives walking around in a fog, in a sense. Not the side that we're familiar with. Sometimes we can walk around very clear, but this other side that we don't know exists in a fog. And so this process of sitting is to allow the fog to go away, to lift, as they say. So one last quick thing, and that is that this issue of confidence and falling down and getting up, one of the wonderful things about functioning in a sangha is that we are all on the same path together. And I think we're all familiar with this, at least I've always been, how helpful it is to sit with kindred spirit, to sit with other people that are on the path. And just hanging out together is supportive. But if you have a spiritual buddy or buddies that we talk with, it also supports us. So don't miss the power, the importance of a sangha. I just had this funny thought. Usually I talk like this if I've had caffeine. I never shut up. But I haven't had any caffeine, so I don't know. But anyway, thank you for listening.